Welcome to the Third Hour, a Latter-day Saint home study podcast. This season, we're discussing the Hebrew Bible. Our goals? To improve our appreciation of the gospel, to investigate the scriptures more thoroughly, to discuss tricky passages, and to build our faith. Some of our talking points will be familiar. Others will sound new. That's okay. Together, we'll learn something new about the Hebrew Bible, no matter our starting level. Welcome again to the Third Hour podcast. We're glad to have you. Greetings, Third Hour listeners. This is episode 30 of the Third Hour podcast, The Lost Ark. I'm your host, Taylor.
Amanda.
I am Andrew.
This week we are covering 1 Samuel chapters 1 through 7. You want to give us a synopsis, Amanda?
So Elkanah and Hannah are married, but Hannah hasn't had any children. So on their annual trip to Shiloh to do sacrifices, Hannah stays outside the temple and prays for a baby. The local priest, Eli, misinterprets her prayers as drunken rambling. She explains, he says the Lord will give her a baby. She then gets pregnant with Samuel, turns him over to Eli at Shiloh. She is eventually blessed with 5 more children. However, Eli has terrible sons. I would not turn my kid over to him. And these sons take the part of the sacrifice that's supposed to go to the Lord, and Eli doesn't do anything about it. He gets told by someone, who I assume is euphemistically an angel, but that his family will get cut off and another priest will be raised. Next, we get the classic story of Samuel hearing a voice in the temple, thinking it's Eli, getting told it's not, go to bed. This happens 3 times before Eli tells Samuel it's the Lord. Samuel listens, and he also gets told that Eli's family will be destroyed. Morning comes, and Eli bullies Samuel into telling him the prophecy. And Eli still doesn't do anything about his sons. Then Israel and the Philistines go to war. Israel is losing, so Eli's sons bring the Ark of the Covenant out of Shiloh and take it to the battlefield. Only Israel loses completely, and Eli's sons die. Someone comes back to tell Eli, and he dies on the spot. So then Philistine takes the Ark back to their temple, but they keep waking up to find the statue of their god toppled over at the feet of the Ark. So they move the Ark around Philistine, the country, but as it moves, a plague of tumors and rats spreads with it. Eventually, they put the Ark and some gold offerings on a cart and send it back to Israel. Samuel calls the people to repentance, offers a sacrifice, and rules as the last judge.
Cool.
You gave me an impression during your synopsis.
Oh, yeah.
That hadn't even occurred to me. It just occurred to me that, like, the episode with Eli and Hannah is just, like, it's just so relevant. Like, a woman in the, like, she must be drunk.
Yeah.
And then how does he recover? You're super righteous and God's going to give you exactly what you want.
Well, and I appreciate that she doesn't tell him what she wants. She just says that I've been speaking out of my great anxiety and vexation in verse 16. And then Eli, how we've talked before about the priest will just say vague things. Mm-hmm. And Eli says, the God of Israel grant the petition you have made him. Not will, but kind of like,
yeah,
there's a hedging there. Like, so she doesn't really tell him what she wants and he doesn't really tell, like, it's like, may it be, not a it will be. Yes, I have a question about placebo effect going on here.
I love how this starts because it sets the tone really well. So I'll be totally open. I love Samuel. It's one of my favorites. And when I say Samuel, I mean 1st and 2nd Samuel. They're the same book.
Yeah.
The only reason they're divided is because of the length of scrolls.
Oh, so you, when you say you love Samuel, you love the books of Samuel.
Yeah, I love the book of Samuel or the books of Samuel, however you want to phrase it. And part of it is that none of the characters really escape. This is going to be really gritty and realistic. And we're going to see characters that are, especially David, that we're going to see a character start out as idealistic, but still shrewd and political, all the way to him basically being a decaying lump on his deathbed. And it's going to be really uncompromising in that portrayal. And it's going to be actually, it's really weird that this is part of the Deuteronomistic history. It probably is, but this is actually going to present something that's a really far cry from the nationalistic, you know, rah, rah narrative that Deuteronomy presents elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it's likely that whoever is writing this is being filtered through D, but their history is probably so solid And I don't mean in terms of modern historiography, I mean in terms of the memory that they create, and we can talk more about that later, but that it really can't escape, that this becomes the identity of David. When you think of David, you think of, you know, the boy who kills Goliath and the guerrilla warrior against Saul and the king who's kind of insular and paranoid and not very effective, and the man who ruins his own kingdom. You get this slice that almost seems like they should be different characters, but they're all folded into one character, which gives us some, there's a lot of indications that whoever is writing at this, even though some things are going to be bigger than they should be, that we really have no evidence that the United Monarchy was ever as big as it's going to say.
Yeah. And of course they're going to exaggerate that. I mean, that just seems so natural.
It's probably never really unified. It's probably never that big. It's not that coherent. It was probably really small. It was probably one of many city-states. But that it's preserving something true. It has a very, what we would call, history-like tone. Okay. But at the same time, we know it's not history because there's a lot of internal dialogue. It'll tell you the thoughts of its characters, what their goals are.
People break into musical numbers.
Yeah, they break into song. And so I love the way that this story starts because it's a microcosm for the entire thing. And it tells you exactly what kind of narrative it is going to be because we start with a classic Annunciation story. We've seen some before. We're going to see some in the future, all the way up through Jesus, which is riffing on a genre. And the genre is in here, right? And this is an inversion. It's satirical because rather than the Annunciation, so the woman comes in, she wants a child. We immediately get it, right? We've seen this narrative so many times before. Yeah. Oh, the second wife, who's kind of a nag.
Right.
Yeah.
She's rude to the first wife. She has children. First wife doesn't. How many times have we seen this? We already know the format. And then she goes in, but rather than the Annunciation coming from something divine, an angel or whatnot, it's this old useless priest
who's on his way out.
He's sitting by the door. He's not really doing much. He's introduced sitting by the door, the same place he will be introduced when he dies, just sitting there. Not really acting. He's kind of a passive leader, not very effective. And he sees this woman, and rather than it being the vessel of Annunciation to her, he accuses her and then gives her exactly what you said, Amanda, kind of this brush off, like, so you're not drunk. The Lord grant your petition. Doesn't know what it is accidentally correct.
Right.
At least on his part. Maybe the Lord in this story used that to his benefit, to his ends. But for Eli's purposes, just doddering and useless. So it's taking a form we've seen before and we'll see again and just flipping it on its head. And these characters are human. These are not the great heroes of old. Now, we've seen that many times these authors have been comfortable showing flaws, but we're going to get a different kind of flaw. These aren't going to be grandiose, tragic flaws in all cases. Sometimes it's just going to be that even the good acts that some of these characters do will be tainted by things like expediency or power hunger or greed or lust, that even the good things they do are very earthy. And that makes this a really exciting text because it's probably, what is the identity of its author? He probably thinks of himself as a historian.
Yeah.
He's trying to actually faithfully transmit something. Now, that means something different in this time period than it would mean to us. To us, it would mean factual transmission. To this person, it means transmission of a meaning. He's trying to tell you something about this, this dynasty. But he's still trying to be faithful to reality in a way that other authors have not been. And that really is exciting to me because we are starting to see that transition from embellished legend to what we would consider history, which I think is really fun. And the opening story just plunges us right into that.
Yeah, I love what you're saying. And actually, my real impression was kind of along those lines because, you know, I said at the beginning when we talked about why are we doing this, and one of the things I said is like, I just think we need to figure out how to wrestle with narratives around prophets better in our church today because we can't deal with them being human, like really human.
Yeah.
And I feel like this is a great story where we can do that, right? I mean, we've got nepotism issues. We've got lazy ineffectiveness. We've got like
structuring power.
We've got succession crises, which we've had multiple of in our church. We don't like to talk about it, but they've happened. So I feel like this feels so relevant. And I really loved what you were saying kind of near the end there about too, that the flaws are more earthy. Like it's not Samson. It's like slaughtering thousands of people. And there are times when that's appropriate. And we've talked about that a little bit, that like we have some of these really big problems today too, but we also have tons of these kinds of problems, right? People just being greedy, including people that we don't want to deal with being able to be greedy.
Yeah.
And so I really appreciate the author's willingness to deal with that and give us a place to try and think about it. What does that mean? What does that mean about God? What does that mean about, you know, my relationship to a leader who might be an instrument in the hands of God accidentally, but at other times, unbeknownst to me, actually has God's furious at him because of nepotism. Anyway, I don't know what my conclusions are, but I feel like here we have an author who is willing to wrestle with some of those same questions, and it feels really relevant.
Yeah, the way I would phrase it is there is a banality to their flaws.
Yeah.
Their flaws aren't, oh, he has a soft spot for women who reveal secrets. You know, like, okay, well, that's like a pulp novel problem.
Right.
Most of us are not having that problem day to day, like Samson. These are problems like once he obtains power, he is very jealous to surrender it.
Yeah.
Which I think most of even a relationship, you can see that kind of thing.
Right.
In
human nature.
Yeah. So I love the banality that we're going to see here.
Well, my only impression was, is like, I'm super familiar with chunks of this, which once again are the chunks that we talked about in Come Follow Me and ignored the rest of it. Come Follow Me was just the first three chapters. And then you skip over until chapter 8.
Oh, I thought they would like the wandering ark.
Nope. We
the other gods falling down in front of the ark. I would have expected that to make them to come follow me.
Well, and like I had just expected like the whole, we've read the whole of other things, other real crazy things. Let's read the whole of Samuel. And we did not. It was like some particular excision there. But so in my head, I'm familiar with how Samuel comes to be and the story of young Samuel and getting summoned. And then in my head, I just thought, I just must have not paid attention to the rest of Samuel's story. And then like, oh, no, that's it. For a book named after Samuel, he is a background character in two other people's stories. He doesn't get a narrative. He doesn't really do anything. We get a verse that, and he was a great prophet who delivered several visions and everyone knew. And I really like the phrase that they use, that he was a trustworthy prophet of the Lord and none of his words fall to the ground. They do that in 3:19. I really liked that phraseology that he was trusted, like that's how good his prophecies were. But like, you're not giving me any.
We were going to hear from him a little bit more. He's going to do some kingmaking and complaining about it.
Well, because the beginning of verse of chapter 8 is when Samuel became old. Like, uh-oh, we're already at the end.
Yeah.
But like, you made me read for chapters about Samson and bees.
Yeah, it seems like they don't like to spend too much time in places that I sometimes would spend more time. I mean, I feel like the beginning, like you said, is really familiar to us. I don't know that I necessarily want to rehash it again. Praying for a son, Samuel's born, and he gets called. I mean, we know this story really well. So one question I had, the genealogy, though, tells us that Samuel is an Ephraimite, right? So what makes it so he can officiate in the temple? How does that work?
Okay, so that's super vague, isn't it? And that is actually going to, in Chronicles, he's going to receive a totally separate lineage.
Okay. And is that going to connect him to the Levites?
Yes. And that will be a Levitical lineage. But in this one, it seems less concerned with that, which actually might fit into the Deuteronomistic history. So this particular text seems more interested in establishing the Zadokite priesthood.
Totally. I never had one.
Yeah, that one. So Zadok, who is going to be the head of the priesthood under the United Monarchy.
Okay.
And it seems like this story is in part trying to explain the transition of the House of Eli to the House of Zadok.
Okay.
So, for example, this mysterious stranger comes. There's no indication he's an angel.
No, anytime a mysterious stranger pops up, I assume.
But I think actually it's vague for that reason. So that the reader can sort of assume their own thing into there without the author having to actually provenance anything. Hmm. Like, they don't have to refer to any vision or visitor that anybody actually had. They just say, well, a mysterious guest said this thing. And look, it came true.
Yeah.
But we get a few hints that maybe something was going weird in terms of the Levitical setup anyway. So you'll notice that when the two sons of Eli, that they sleep with the women who are attending the front of the sanctuary.
And at this point, I just assume that's a euphemism.
Well, you know, and there's that question. Are those temple prostitutes? We know that cultic prostitutes are common, that they existed in the time of David, so likely before. It's not like David instituted that.
I don't know. David.
Yeah, David. So this is in 222. But it adds this, and it's a phrase where it talks about how the sons of Eli are sleeping with the women at the front of the sanctuary. So are they temple prostitutes? Are they people who, like Samuel, have been gifted? Remember that Jephthah's daughter, who we were like, well, he totally sacrificed her. But some people say, well, maybe Jephthah turned her over. This is kind of where you would get that justification. Maybe she was turned over to this, even though the text totally does not say that. So maybe she was one of the women who works at the front of the temple. But regardless of what's happening, it does seem like this narrative already, the notion of Levitical priesthood is porous. There do seem to be people outside of that Levitical priesthood assuming responsibilities. So the answer is we don't know and we can't know. But there are suppositions we can make. Mm-hmm. One of them being that there's no evidence of ever having been a Levitical class.
Yeah.
So it could be something like that. It could be that whatever that class is has already begun to lose their grip. And now we are getting justifications for the House of Zadok to be ascendant in lieu of the House of Eli.
And just to remind listeners, Zadok, that's connected to Melchizedek, Melchizedek, right?
Yeah.
Remind me what the prefix means, why that...
It means king of.
Okay.
So Zadok is my king, could be the name that Melchizedek means. Very possible that was retrojected. You might remember when we read that in the Abraham narrative, it's very inserted.
Yeah.
A lot of ambiguity. It would make sense if you were trying to establish kind of a priestly ruling class to be like, well, look, even Father Abraham came and paid tithes to this priesthood, even though there's no indication that the priesthood had yet been established, since the priesthood is lineage-based and the lineage that would make it hasn't been born for a number of generations. So, so there's a lot of wiggle room there. And many theologians are going to try to reconcile that because of the assumption that the text is univocal and is always telling us something. Among them, Joseph Smith, who is going to see, well, House of Zadok, Melchizedek, maybe these all mean something, therefore maybe they mean a priesthood. There's really nothing to indicate that. If you look at it through a pure historical lens, these start to look more like insertions with the express purpose of structuring power for particular groups.
Yeah. Although that power did have a flavor that we would recognize as somewhat priestly, didn't it? I mean, it did.
Yes.
So in that sense.
In that case, yes. And there's going to be a tension, right? So this narrative, we talked in Judges that it seems like it's looking forward to the monarchy.
Yeah.
This narrative is not going to think much of the monarchy.
Yeah, it kind of goes back and forth, but it's mostly negative.
Yeah, and it's going to seem that whoever is writing this, likely at least editing it or something during the Babylonian captivity, and there's some clues even in this reading that we can look at. It's likely that they think the monarchy was a failed experiment, that really what would have been better would have been a strong theocratic government led by priests. But they look at this and say, well, look, the priestly class kind of fell apart.
Yeah.
And therefore Samuel was called and the people want a king. And
Samuel's called. God's even kind of trying to repair it, but then the people reject that.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. I can definitely see that. One other thing I noticed in here, and I hope I'm not jumping ahead too much, but since we're talking about authorship, I think it makes sense to bring it up here, is that I noticed a lot of sacrificing away from the temple, which I wouldn't have expected in the Deuteronomistic history. Because it felt less like they were driving into centralization. Would we explain that in the same way, just that maybe it's the same school? So the model I have in my head right now, and you can maybe kind of correct me, is you have this school that's writing over time, over much time, right? And maybe even spans a little bit the exile. So like pre-exile, they have one set of priorities that they really care about, like wanting to have a monarchy. And post-exile, they've changed it. There's still some continuity there. But there's also some things that they've changed, like how they feel about the monarchy. That's kind of the way I'm piecing it together right now. How accurate is that to what scholars imagine?
I think that has general consensus. I mean, so when we talk about schools, you know, that there's a priestly school and a Levitical school, and that they have these different goals. You have to remember that for most of these, there's no actual written evidence that they existed.
Right.
We get that mostly by the arguments that they're making. And also more and more corroborated by archaeological evidence that shows that we did have like a landed aristocracy with interests in the priestly rulership, right? Like ties to the cultic apparatus of the state. With this, you're right in the sense that the school that has the most evidence for it, textually and otherwise, is the Deuteronomistic school.
Yeah.
It's likely that it has fewer authors than most of the other traditions. But it's likely that those authors did have developing interests, just necessarily, because if you're living in a kingdom in decline on the eve of conquest, you have different interests than someone who's living in exile, who's editing this specific book, and you don't think much of the monarchy that led your people to ruin,
right,
versus somebody after that who's totally cool with you being a Persian satrapy. A vassal state, specifically in an administrative district within Persia, where you have a king, kind of, you have a dynasty, but honestly, it's marginal. It's clearly effectively a regional governor, and you're fine with that because your people are prospering. And that can be one basic class that you're the same family, or you're the same school, you're the same educated caste.
Yeah, you're handing down documents. So there's some are lost too, but there's some continuity on some level of what you have access to.
And you can see how basically the same caste could have effectively similar interests, but that are altered in part by just the trajectory of history.
Yeah.
Now, what interests do they share? Pretty much that they want to stay in power.
Yeah.
You can usually bank on that. That's a pretty reliable motivation, that you don't want your group to be thrown out of power.
Yeah.
But this group has some tensions, doesn't it? Because let's say that you're the same group that was saying during the Josiah reforms, like, oh, we have to have a strong nation and we have to have this particular idea of covenant. Well, then it doesn't work.
Right.
It isn't the liberals and libertines who destroyed your country. It was that, well, you did harden your cult and you were still overthrown by Babylon.
Yeah.
So what is your conclusion? Well, now you're authoring something like 1 Samuel, and who becomes the scapegoat now? Well, it's not so much like the wickedness of the people. It's the former house, the former priestly house, and then a monarchy that was self-interested instead of creating a strong state.
Yeah.
So the scapegoat changes. Now, I'm speaking incredibly broadly.
Yeah.
But you can, and I'm offering this just as a hypothetical.
Yeah.
But you can see how the same class would reach different conclusions depending on when they're authoring their history or when they're editing previous history.
Yeah.
And at times when reading that can seem like conflicting aims, because it is, but it can be coming from the same individual even.
Yeah.
Or the same school or the same class. There's a lot of different ways to phrase that, but we do see a continuity of interest, even if we don't see a continuity of who they blame for their woes.
Right. Yeah, it's really fast. I mean, I'm loving reading this stuff because, again, it just feels so relevant. I mean, to see people trying to look back, oh, that thing that we hung our hat on, that we like put the stake in the ground, was wrong. Now what? Like, how do we maintain a sense of identity, because our identity became so bound up in that stake that we pounded into the ground, right? So how do we maintain some sense of identity? How do we maintain our power structure? How do we get people to listen to anything else we have to say? Like, there's just, I see the way we deal with this today. And it just, I don't know, it just feels really relevant. I'll try to stop saying that.
Well, one way that I think that you can glimpse this is, remember in the Deuteronomistic code, it tends to favor landed aristocrats.
Yeah.
Well, it seems in here that their power is sort of shifting into the urban sphere, and becoming more connected with like palace intrigues. So it would make sense when you're a landed aristocrat, you're like, you know what benefits us is a king. Because now things are more stable, so we can do more landed aristocratic things like growing and trading.
Yeah.
That's how we gain wealth and prestige. But as that, they get what they wish for. Okay, they prop up a king. Well, now the problem is now they have to spend more time at court.
Yeah.
Now things are more centralized, and they realize, well, this king can tax us.
Yeah.
And
the king becomes a threat.
Yeah, now the king is the problem,
yeah.
And we're no longer landed aristocrats. Now we're court officials, and we're still the people who are literate, who have ties to this priesthood class. But now the person that we're not unhappy with, you know, rural charismatic judges. Now we're unhappy that this king has interests in his own favor.
Yeah.
And so you can see, and again, I'm not saying this is the case. I'm saying this is a hypothetical model that can help us explain how one seeming school of authorship with very consistent, certain interests can suddenly change which side it seems to think it's on. Previously, monarchy, monarchy, monarchy. Now they're kind of like, prophet? But like the right prophet, not the house of Eli,
right?
The house of Zadok.
Yeah.
And so you can see that shifting, which is really fun. But you do have to be willing to play around with the hypothetical models and think outside of your Sunday school box in order to reach that.
Yeah. It's so much more simple to read the Bible when you can let yourself out of the Sunday school box a little bit. The Bible doesn't fit there. At some point, you got to accept that. It doesn't even fit in the Deuteronomist's Sunday school box. Right. Should we talk about Hannah's song?
Sure.
I just kind of noticed the same thing my footnotes point out. My footnote says it fits neither Hannah's situation nor her personality. And it did kind of feel like that to me. It's like, oh, I'm reading a psalm all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Where'd that come from?
Yeah, it's kind of a generic song of Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
But it's very nice.
So I don't really know what else do we want to say. I mean, as Amanda pointed out, we could kind of go from Samuel being this attendant in the temple. He's unknown. He gets the call. The curse of Eli is repeated. And then he becomes fairly well known, it seems like, by the end of chapter 3. His prophecies are well known.
One of the things I wanted to point out, because I'm just going to keep doing this, because I just keep getting baffled every single time. I pulled open the Come Follow Me, and as I said, you only read chapters 1 through 3,
yeah.
And then you skip. But the title that goes in Come Follow Me with 1 Samuel chapter 3 is, I can hear and obey the voice of the Lord. That's nice. What do you learn from this young boy about hearing and obeying the Lord's voice? And then it proceeds to talk about yourself. And then as I was putting together the summary, I went, what was Samuel's thing about again? What was this vision? And I went back and went, wait a second. Eli already got told to do that thing. It's not a vision for Samuel. It's like a repeat for Eli, just in case you missed it from your own common sense and random strangers.
In case you couldn't handle prophetic nepotism.
Yeah. And let me hand you the little boy who is clearly your replacement and have him tell you what you're doing wrong. Like, yeah. Just in case you missed it from all the other places, let's get it again. And the fact that, and like, there's something to be said about God talking to Samuel and Samuel going into Eli and Eli, like, not coaching him through it, just telling him, yeah, the next time God talks to you, just say, I'm here, go for it.
Yeah.
Like, instead of Eli, like, seeking revelation on his own. Yeah,
Eli does seem kind of lazy.
Oh, yeah. There's super duper conversation to be had about that. But we've reached one of the stories that I'm super familiar with, and I even pulled open the video. And so even in the video, we cut out what his vision is about.
Yeah.
We cut out the message that he's being given, and we're cutting out it says in Come Follow Me, I can hear and obey the voice. There's nothing for him to obey here. He's not being given a command. This is not how we generally tend to structure and view what you're supposed to do with a vision. And it was like, I have never thought about that before. That, like, we get told the story of Samuel over and over and over again. And that he went and he listened and it was so great. And, like, listen to what? He told Eli to stop being so lazy. Eli got that mess. It's not for Samuel.
He didn't even tell Eli to stop being so lazy. He just warned Eli he's going to get killed again.
Yeah, because it can't, like, the last verse of it is, I swear to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be expiated by sacrifice or offering forever. So there's nothing for him to even tell, technically.
Yeah.
Like, okay. Yeah, your house is bad. There's literally nothing you can do. God has already condemned you.
Which is, I get, well, there's a whole conversation to be had about that. Like, I don't know how I feel about that, but we'll just put that on the shelf and move. We'll just chalk that up to Old Testament stuff and move right along.
And that's just Hebrew Bible-y. But I think maybe because we have to read it through that lens, right? Like, listen to the voice of the Lord. But really what this chapter is saying is it's a transferring of mantle.
Yeah.
Because it begins by saying the word of the Lord was rare in those days.
Yeah.
Visions were not widespread. That's directly a condemnation of the house of Eli. Because he's the one who's supposed to be going and having ecstatic visions and making prophecies and oracles. He's not doing that. So when it says visions were not widespread, it's not saying like in the whole land. It's saying that the house of Eli is being negligent. And so now who's going to be receiving the oracles and visions? Well, Samuel.
Yeah.
So the very fact that Samuel is called is an indication that he is more qualified as basically a serving boy than Eli. So really it's propaganda.
Yeah.
It's trying to overthrow or at least justify. It's not actively trying to, it is in past tense, but it's trying to justify the overthrow of a previous priestly order.
Yeah.
Which is really not what we get out of it. And I would think that our priestly leaders maybe don't want us to get that out of it.
but you got to read the rest of the chapter to understand what you're supposed to be getting at. And like, even just in like vague spiritual terms, if what you want us to get out of it is to hear and obey the Lord, perhaps Eli's lesson of hearing and not, like the negative of the lesson you want us to get out of it might be more effective than once you read the whole chapter surrounding Samuel to be like, oh, you're just shoehorning something in here that like.
In a way, the contemporary message for me is actually very uncomfortable for the church because I look at this and I say, okay, well, where are your miracles? So if I pray and I receive something that just says the iniquity of the church shall not be expiated by sacrifice or offering, I mean, that's more in line with what the story is actually about. There's no step of obedience necessary. It's really just mantle was lost. So I think there's a reason the church tries to present it in through that lens, whether it's conscious or not.
No, super not conscious, because you have to read the whole chapter to make conscious decisions about things. And there's no place for me to go with this. I just really, if I had Andrew's degree, would write a paper about it. There you go. I give you this paper idea.
I do write lots of my own papers.
I know. The amount of research I would have to do to turn this into a thing, so I can't turn it into a thing. I just enjoy the idea. It's about the transferring of currently the metaphorical mantle and eventually the literal mantle. And you've got this little boy running around in priestly clothes that every time his mom like knits him a new one. So I appreciate it.
A lovely detail.
Yes, I loved it that. Yeah. It was so, and like I could just visualize it and like the little 4-year old and like his little priestly outfit.
Yeah,
I
his little
it.
Ephod.
It was so sick. It's like envisioning a little kid in a little apron and it was super cute. I enjoyed that. But his mother, who despite all of the uselessness around her. And like there are questions to be had about Elkanah he seems to be a nice dude. He's nice to his wife. That's good.
But he doesn't get it.
No. Right? And he's the one, he doesn't get it. And he's doing sacrifices at this place involving people who are clearly corrupt and taking the stuff that's supposed to go to the Lord. Eli is useless. So there's, again, a whole thing. But she's the one who puts forth enough effort to get the blessing to have the kids and then makes little mantles for Samuel. And then we have a metaphorical and a literal transferring of the mantle. I really appreciated that. Don't know what to do with it, but I liked it.
Oh, I appreciate you pointing that out. I enjoyed it as like a really nice detail in the story, but I didn't connect it to like the mantle. I kind of like it's like Sam's growing into it almost.
Yeah. My footnotes over and over again point out, so it talks about several word plays in the chapter on the name of Saul. In Hebrew, it says Shaul. So several of the things sound like the name Saul, and gives a whole bunch of puns on the name Saul. Oh, there we go. Found all of them. And some scholars think, based on these puns, that the story was originally about Saul's birth rather than Samuel's. Others think they are simply allusions to Saul as Israel's first king. And after our troubles in Ruth, and how my footnotes in Ruth were all, and she just slept at his feet the whole entire night, even though the last time we used feet, it was a euphemism for other things. This time, feet means feet. So now I call into question all of my footnotes and double crying and cross-reference them with Andrew. So
the etymology is wrong. So the etymology where it means like lent to God, asked and lent, is correct of Saul, but not Samuel.
Oh.
So it could be blurring that line, because they're similar names.
When you say it's correct of Saul, but not Samuel, like they put the wrong case on it?
Or yeah,
like...
so Shaul means asked and lent.
Okay.
Whereas Samuel does not.
Shmuel?
Yeah, Shmuel.
Oh, that's me. Don't name your kid Shmuel.
As opposed to Shaul. But they're very close. And as you may have deduced, a lot of the etymology in here is just things sounding close to things, which happens a lot. And there's that L, right? So of God.
Yeah.
Saul, or Samuel, Shmuel. Mm-hmm. So kind of the same. So you're right. A lot of scholars have suspected that this story is probably inserted in some way. And that it's appropriating something about the story of Saul and turning it into the story of Samuel. Mm-hmm. That is not universal. That is just something that some scholars speculate. A great number of other scholars disagree vehemently, but it's possible. And the reason that it's useful to introduce a concept like that is because it's always useful to draw people to the power dynamics at play, that whoever's writing this is trying to say something, and that whoever's writing this kind of doesn't like the monarchy, so they might be trying to shift some of the propheticness of lent to God from Saul to Samuel. Mm. That's possible. I would put that kind of in like a second tier back hypothetical, mm-hmm. where maybe. I don't think it's quite as likely as some of the other stuff we've discussed, but I know there are scholars who would disagree with that. So yeah, possible.
So I find this conversation fascinating in part because I've been thinking a lot. So you started this out with the come follow me approach to this.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking a lot of this week about our discussion of Ruth last time and just all the layers of meaning that book alone has had in my life alone.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's that verse, may a full reward be given you, by the God in whose wings you come to trust. I'm paraphrasing, I don't remember exactly, but that has particular meaning to my family. There's a reason that I find that verse, like it brings a lot of particular set of memories. And so I've been thinking about like, how do I stack all these meanings together? And actually I have this dual reaction to what you're saying about come follow me with Samuel, because on the one hand, I like completely agree with everything you said, but then on the other hand, I'm like, well, but I think there is, I wouldn't mind my kids being told this simple story of like, God might call you and you can learn to recognize the call and good things can come of that. Right. Like, And so one of my kind of impressions overall lately has just been like, it's good to stack these things on top of each other. There, no one of them is like wrong unless you insist it's the only one. Then it becomes really problematic. Unless you aren't open to problems with seeing it that way, right? Like, I just think the Bible is this constant challenge to re-examine how we think the world works, to re-examine who we think God is, to re-examine, and the Bible itself is doing it all the time. I've loved this idea of like God progressing in the Bible. And I realized the other day, like, oh my goodness, it's like a perfect Christian story. It coalesces in God finally throwing up his hands and being like, I just got to go experience it myself. I'm never going to figure these guys out. That's like the perfect setup for the New Testament in some ways. Anyway, so I love all these layers, and where earlier in our experience with this, I was deeply uncomfortable because I was trying to make them all like, now it's just like, no, like they all have a use and they're all really limited. And if I can't accept their limits, then they will all break in a deeply toxic way. But at the same time, like if I can accept their limits, then even some of these really simple meanings can still be meaningful, but I have to let them be the children's stories that they are, not the complex reflection of a complex reality that I want them to be. Anyway, well, there's like I'm ranting now a little bit.
No, not at all. I think that's useful. And I think one of the ways that it's useful is that there's a central tension in here. You know, we'll read, follow the prophet. Well, he is not called as the prophet. He's called as a prophet. And why should we value him over the house of Eli?
Yeah.
Now, it's going to give us reasons.
Right.
So, you know, they're still in the meat. But what if you're looking at a priestly apparatus and you say, well, I feel like they're stealing the meat in today's terms? There's always that tension, especially in the Hebrew Bible, that, yeah, follow the prophet. You know, so, for example, in Sunday school, we had one of those sum up lessons, right? Like everyone go around the room, say your favorite part of the Old Testament. Three people in the class mentioned Amos 3:7. Surely the Lord God will do nothing save you reveal it first to his servants, the prophets. That verse has been added later. It's an addition. And also it's really incongruent with kind of the surrounding text. One of the reasons is because there's tons of prophets in that time period, all saying contradictory things.
Right.
And if you read the 12 minor prophets, allowing yourself to see that, they are contradicting on major theological and cultic, as in practice, points. The same thing is going on here. If you're an outsider, so if you're this family that just goes in and sacrifices, why would you value the house of Zadok over the house of Eli?
Right.
You don't necessarily know that these people are corrupt. Or if you see corruption, how do you know that you can get a call and become a new charismatic prophet? So you're right, that lesson is there, but it's also a lesson that's very much in tension with itself in the text. And I think actually the author is aware of that.
Yeah.
Because Samuel is not going to turn into a storybook prophet. He's going to be a very self-interested and jealous of ceding his power prophet. And that's important. But I think it requires us reading past chapter 3.
Yes. Reading the whole text is great.
Yeah.
At some point. I mean, you have to grow up.
in their defense, the next week was Samuel 8 through 10, 13, and 15 through 18. I don't know what's being cut out. I'll let you know later.
And we'll find out.
Yeah.
It's my favorite part. Every week we get a synopsis, and then we get, what did come follow me?
I didn't used to do it. And then like 1 week, you brought it up that like it was a week you had taught in your Sunday school, and you very deliberately brought up the stuff that like come follow me told you to read the whole thing, but only gave you references and wanted you to talk about like the three things we'd already talked about 7 gabillion times before.
Yeah.
And it was like, I have never thought about that. And so I started looking it up. And so you brought it on yourself.
No, I'm saying I like it.
Yeah. Okay. So then we have this battle with the Philistines. There's a defeat. And in order to solve that, they go get the ark, thinking surely God will help us if we have the ark, apparently. Mm-hmm. I feel like this is another, like, we're seeing the mantle shift again, right? Like,
yeah.
Like, there's this sense, Phinehas, that's his name, right?
Yeah.
And what was the other one's name?
Hophni.
Hophni. Hophni and Phinehas, like, there aren't the authorized people to be bringing the Ark. That's kind of the sense I get out of this. They bring the Ark. That's not good enough. The Ark gets captured and proceeds to make the Philistines miserable. What did I leave out? What's important that we want to talk about in there?
So many scholars suspect that this is an older narrative that's been kind of like inserted into this story. Like, it changes, right? It, stylistically, it's different. The characters all kind of disappear for a while. Mm-hmm. This is also where God like reappears. This narrative is largely absent of God, like making a direct manifestation of power.
Yeah.
But here, wow. God is like cursing everyone, basically redoing the 10 plagues narrative, except this time it's the poor Philistines who, I don't know if they really deserve it as much as Pharaoh did. Even Pharaoh got warnings.
Yeah.
Well, and the where he chooses to assert his power is not in the battle. It's so like he's not really helping his own people. He's just punishing the people who stole his chair.
Yeah. And so many people have pointed out this is kind of is likely an older story that they told and is being inserted here. But I actually think it has some pretty deep thematic connections to the story. Like Taylor has noted, the passing of the mantle, I think, is one. And maybe we should get to, I mean, it connects to Hannah. It's the same idea. So in this case, mother cows are how it's returned. Mm. This idea of sacrifice being given for a sacrifice. So Hannah, when she takes Samuel, they also take a bull and sacrifice it. In this case, how do the Philistines return the ark? Well, they put it onto two milk cows that have been separated from their children. And it's kind of the ark that leads the way back home, not the cows. And then the cows are sacrificed. So there is this sense of interconnecting the divinity to whatever's going on with these neoteny games, you know, the succession games. So that is in there. Now, I think it is probably connecting a somewhat disparate narrative, but I don't think it's doing it inartfully.
Yeah, I think that I would agree with that. I understood why it was here, for sure.
Yeah. Did anyone like that the offerings are literally swollen buboes and plague rats? I thought that was fun.
Swollen buboes.
Yeah, so did you notice that the gold that the Philistines send are 5 tumors? As in, because we're talking about the swollen lymph nodes that are buboes. Oh. That's what tumor means. It's not like cancer tumor. It means that when you got a certain type of plague, your lymph nodes on your throat and groin would swell up and be these big, purple, disgusting. That's where tumor comes from. And plague mice. And that's the gold images that they send back to Israel as placation. So kind of interesting. So when it says tumor, that is not a euphemism for like some sort of ornament. That literally is, they made a gold tumor.
My translation translated it hemorrhoid.
Well, that's similar. Yeah. You know, if you know a bubo and you know a tumor and you know a hemorrhoid, you know, zoom in close enough, you could mix up one for the other.
I did notice though that was the offering. I thought that was really fascinating. Actually, I kind of, and again, like there's just such a humanness to it, right? Like we'll do anything. Like this is awful, and it is awful. And it just, you know, what if we take our problem and offer it to God? Right. I mean, like, it's so human in so many ways and beautiful. And anyway, I did notice that and I enjoyed that. And I felt like they also like cast lots with the cows. I noticed, like, cause didn't they say like, if the cows go one way, then we don't actually have to give the ark back.
Yeah.
But if the cows, like, of their own accord, take the ark back, then we better not stop them.
Yeah. There's so many little peculiarities in this story. Like, when in verse 15 of chapter 6, it says, so basically the cows just, like, walk into a town, right? Yeah. And so they sacrifice them. But in verse 15, it makes sure to add, the Levites did it.
Yeah, I noticed that.
And likely that wasn't there originally. It doesn't fit into the sentence. It's really shoehorned. So it goes into town. Oh, the Levites do it, but then they do the offering there. Kind of weird if you have a central sanctuary.
Right.
Probably we don't yet. You get this really weird story about, so everyone shouts for joy, but the people of Jaconia didn't. And the translation gets super wonky here. So this is in verse 19. The descendants of Jaconia did not rejoice with the people of Beth Shemesh when they greeted the ark. And so he, God, killed some of them. And depending on whether you're reading the Masoretic text or the Septuagint or the Qumran scrolls, it changes the number that's killed. Like one of them says, I think 15,000. Another one said just says 70. And it just seems like maybe 70 people died of something, like maybe the plague that came over from Philistia. And then they're just like, well, maybe they didn't celebrate enough. And like, why is this story in there? It doesn't really seem to serve a purpose except maybe a weird etiological nod.
Yeah.
But also like other people are like, oh, it was 15,000. Well, that's way too big for just like some town. Mm-hmm. That's not a city. That's a shepherd town. There are not 15,000 people.
Mine says 50.
Okay. So I guess I got it wrong. So it's supposed to be 50,000.
You didn't exaggerate enough.
I didn't exaggerate enough. It's supposed to be 50,000, which is bananas. Most modern translations will not say the 50,000. They just say the 70. Because in Hebrew, it's missing the and that would say 50,000 and 70. Like that's not in Hebrew. And so it just seems very improbable that that would be in there.
Yeah, my translation reads this way. The Lord struck at the men of Beth Shemesh because they looked into the ark of the Lord. He struck down 70 men among the people and 50,000 men. And it puts the and in brackets, and then there's all sorts of footnotes about like,
Yeah.
But my thought when I read this was like, oh, that's where they got that idea for Indiana Jones. Yes.
And that's a very Jewish reading of it.
Okay.
That's going to be absent from at least one of the Septuagint documents, and it's not in the Qumran scrolls. So very partial.
Yeah.
Just, I'm not throwing that in to learn a big lesson. I'm just saying, actually, Samuel is a really hard document because it's so fragmentary. That we have all of these little sources for it, but we don't really have like an origin document that seems complete.
Oh. Super fascinating.
Thanks for saying that, Taylor.
but it really is. So then the ark ends up with Abinadab. I mean, just sort of like that's the end. I was really surprised by like the super non-climactic ending.
Just
I mean,
partly because
I'm thinking about this being like the centralization impulse. I kept expecting it to like go back to the temple.
Yeah.
Right. But no, it's just like this dude up on the hill and they consecrate his son Eleazar, which that's the name of Aaron's son, right? Am I remembering that right? Eleazar?
It's a very common name.
It's a common name, but it's still anyway. They consecrate him to be in charge of the ark. And that's it. I felt like that was really anticlimactic.
So now Samuel turns into one of the charismatic judges, right?
Yeah.
But so this, let me give you a hint. This is one of the hints that this is probably being written during the Babylonian exile. So in verse 5, Samuel says, "Gather all Israel at Mizpah." Now that specifically is Mizpah and Benjamin. There's multiple Mizpahs. "And I will pray to the Lord for you." Mizpah is actually, so why is it there? That's a tiny little town. Mizpah is the administrative center when they are a suzerain under Babylon.
Oh.
So if you're writing it during that period and you're thinking of like, what's a big important gathering place, then it's Mizpah. But at no point before or after is it. So basically for 90 years in that window, it's an important place. Other than that, it's not very noteworthy.
I feel like here too, we're seeing again, I mean, the transfer of the mantle is just being beat into our heads here. I feel like, I mean, when Phinehas and Hophni bring the ark, it's a total failure. Here, the ark is up on a hill somewhere, but Samuel's presence as the judge is enough to result in enormous success. And in fact, specifically, if I recall correctly, we're going to take by name the same towns that the ark had traveled through and failed to give Israelites territory. So I just felt like this, so the towns where which the Philistines had taken from Israel, from Ekron to Gath. So I guess it doesn't mention Ashtaroth, but Ekron and Gath were both towns where the ark had been. Anyway, so again, this sense that like Samuel's the leader now. And then as you, I think you pointed this out, Amanda, like it does feel like verse 15 reminds me of Judges. Like, okay, here's the end of Samson. Here's the end of here's the summary statement. Mm-hmm. This judge ruled X number of years and, you know, it feels like it's ending here. Of course, in some sense, it's not, but we are ending this episode here, however. Except we forgot to talk about Ichabod. I love the way that, like, you name your kid some divine meaning.
You're just like, man, things stink. That's the name of my kid.
Well, thank you for listening to this episode of the Third Hour Podcast. Join us next week when we'll do some king making.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us. This was the Third Hour, a Latter-day Saint home study podcast. If you felt any impressions or had any comments, we would love to hear them at thethirdhourpodcast.com. We'll see you next time.